Hey everyone, and welcome to the Woofing Pawsome podcast, the canine podcast for you, the pooch parent, and the dog daft. I'm your host Greg. I'm a dog trainer based up in the northeast of England, and my company is called Great Paws. So, whether you're having a cuppa and snuggling with your dog, out walking your dog, training your dog, or maybe in your car or van driving your dog somewhere, it's an absolute pleasure to have you with us, so let's dive into the next episode. Hey everyone, and welcome to the first episode of Season 2. Now, this was actually recorded during the peak of lockdown with an amazing guest called Katie Aldred, who is a veterinary nurse, but she's also a trainer and behaviourist. She's a fantastic individual with just so much knowledge. I was super, super excited to be able to talk to her about this topic, which is all about vets, specifically taking your dog to the vets, ways to plan for it. And this is probably going to be the first in a few episodes that we do with Katie, and this one we are focused very much on kind of the build up and what we can do to help make vet visits really, really comfortable and really probably enjoyable for both you and Pooch, rather than it being that dreaded visit. But thank you so much for joining me again for Season 2. This is technically episode 31. I'm going to keep the episode numbers concurrent. So, that's enough of me waffling. Let's dive right in. Hi, Katie.
Hi, nice to be with you today.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining me on the Woofing Pawsome podcast. It's going to be cool. So hopefully I'll explain a bit more for the listeners in a moment, but hopefully obviously we'll have you back a few times to cover this topic because it's quite expansive. But before we do dive into that, do you mind, as always with my guests, kind of just giving yourself a bit of an intro and kind of who you are, where you're from, what you do, whatever you'd like to share with the listeners?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Katie Aldred. I am a registered veterinary nurse, and I also have a master's degree in applied animal behaviour and training. I've been working in the animal industry since approximately 2001 and have been in and out of practice during that time. Currently, I work for myself, self-employed, based in Norfolk, and I specialise in behaviour and training and do some locum work here and there. So I'm not working as an employed veterinary nurse at the moment, but one of my sort of passions is teaching cooperative care, if you like, and consent. So I work that into most of my behaviour and training work, consent from animals.
Oh, wow. Fantastic. So who better to talk to then around kind of vet visits, that whole vet experience, obviously with your dog, which is obviously what we'll cover off. And I think, again, just due to the vastness of the topic, I think for the purpose of this podcast, we'll look at the kind of the part one, which for me is that kind of preparation for vet visits, and then also kind of the actual arrival at the vets, whether it's for an appointment or whatever else. Because I think it's one of those things where, depending on your dog, it can be something, in my experience anyway, where you kind of very quickly overlook it because your dog seems okay about it. Whether they are or not might be a different matter, but they're not doing anything that makes you kind of panic or worry or anything like that. Whereas obviously if you do have a dog who does find a vet visit a little bit overwhelming, it's a completely different kettle of fish being on that kind of end of the lead. So I thought what would be lovely to talk about is kind of some of the almost the preemptive things that we can think about in advance of visiting a vet, whether it's with a brand new puppy, with a kind of new dog that's joined the home. What kind of would be your top tips really for anyone looking to make that visit as stress-free and relaxed as possible?
Great. That's a really great question. And when you work in practice, you can always tell the dogs that the owners have either purposely or accidentally done some kind of prep work with them. Generally, it comes down to there's kind of two aspects. So one is the handling, and then the other side is having stays in the vets. So which, of course, is a bit more tricky to prepare for. So handling is probably the number one priority, which at the moment is potentially a bit more tricky for owners to do because of the restrictions of social distancing and things like that. But the owners definitely can be working on the handling with their puppies. So it's much better. Research really sort of suggests that habituation to handling and building resilience in puppies is the way forwards to have a dog that's a puppy that's less stressed and an adult dog that's less stressed for vet visits and handling during vet visits later in life. So that really starts at home with just gentle handling. And actually, something that a lot of people don't realize is really that it starts with the breeder. So one of the questions we should be asking is, what has the breeder done in preparation for the puppy's new home? It's really important. Yeah. So you can start doing things with puppies as soon as they're born. Basically, you've also got to have a good relationship with the mother. So really, breeders, we want to be picking breeders that have put a lot more thought into the breeding and have a good relationship with that female dog so that they will allow that interaction.
Is it early neurological stimulation they generally class it as? And it's kind of like you say, just kind of almost life prepping pooch long before they actually leave the litter.
That's right. And even if people don't do that, just general, very gentle handling, obviously in the first few weeks, and even introduction to different scents and things like that, because puppies, obviously, when they're born, are relying mostly on their sense of smell and heat, which is how they navigate back to their mum, until their eyes and ears start opening. So touch and smells are very important. And then moving into more sort of socialization from the breeder. And the more the breeder does, the more resilient the puppies can leave the home to their new new houses and can make the life for the new owner a lot easier. Then obviously the owner needs to continue that.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I suppose a similar type of line of questioning then I assume would kind of be prevalent if I was going to a rescue, for example, and I was looking at a dog there. I was having those questions around kind of how comfortable is the dog kind of being touched, being handled, whether that's nail clipping, general strokes, ears, kind of all those sensitive areas where some dogs get a little bit more apprehensive, can be massive. So like you said, just asking the questions is a great place to start.
Yeah, so preparation first before taking on a puppy or a dog. If that hasn't been done, you at least know what situation you're in and if you're going to have to put more effort into it. So obviously owners of new puppies or new dogs that they've rescued always put quite an emphasis on that they need to socialise and train them. But one of the key things they forget is life skills in general, really, I suppose it comes under, which is building in these things that they're not going to be prepared for potentially. I always try to encourage owners to try and imagine the future with their puppies or dogs and think about all the things that they're going to be doing with them, be that going on holiday, which means taking them with them maybe to different environments, for example, like the New Forest where there's wild ponies, or having to put them in kennels and really be planning and prepping for that. Which sort of circles back to the handling, because at some point all dogs have to go to the vets. So that's the first point. I'm not sure you were ready for me to go into that, but
No, that's cool. I think this is the key thing, is it's like you say, we do naturally just go down what a dog comes into our life, whether it's a pup or a rescue, however it comes in, we do very much look at the, I want it walk nicely on the lead. I'd like it to come back when we call. But actually, vet visits are obviously just for general health checks. They're going to be what, annually kind of thing. You may have boosters and jabs. And then obviously, if anything goes wrong and you do need obviously some veterinary support, it's going to be something you're doing multiple times, probably through a year. And not prepping and planning for that can make those events really stressful and really kind of overwhelming for the dog and for you.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes even if you've done a lot of work with your dog, you kind of hit the nail on the head a bit there. If you end up having to go in a lot, you can start losing that trust that you've built. And it's a really tricky thing with vet care, because obviously a lot of it is painful and uncomfortable. And as we know, that painful events I remembered significantly more. So it's something that really is ongoing. Even once you've achieved it, you need to keep up and maintain it to try and hit a balance if you lose any of those trust points. So yeah, but so with puppies, I really try to encourage owners to start it really carefully. And one of the things that we always do as humans is rush. So regardless of what it is, whether we're trying to build resilience or train, we always rush the process. And it's very easy to teach a dog to be hand shy without realizing. So I'm always trying to encourage owners to do it really gradually. So over a period of weeks, starting with like really benign areas, if you like. So that could be like the shoulders and things, and just getting them used to just gentle touch, for example, and then working towards those tricky areas, which is normally ears, eyes, inside the mouth, you know, teaching a dog to have their lips lifted and looking at their teeth can be tricky. And feet, normally feet are a bit of a problem area. And then of course, so many people take their dogs to groomers or vets to have their claws clipped. And a lot of animals really hate their feet being handled because they simply aren't used to it. And it's a sensitive area.
That's fantastic. It's so true, because I've recently, probably like a lot of us in dog training world, kind of been moving things online. I did mention this in a previous podcast as well, but I had kind of one of the members of my team and her dog, as we were filming, it's a little staffy called Iris. She's lived with her for 8 years. And we were doing some videos on cooperative care and just how to build up introduction of even things like a grooming brush and nail clippers and that kind of thing. Yeah. And I left a section of the video in for people to see where there is, excuse me, Iris That's offers okay. the paw, which Ellie takes. And then Iris got really uncomfortable with it and pulled the paw back, did a bit of a kind of lip lick and a head turn. And it happens so quickly. 9 times out of 10, we just completely miss it. And that's someone who's obviously had, you know, they've lived together for 8 years. And even despite all that time, just like us, there's, I suppose, appropriate times when you want to be handled and when there isn't. And if you're not prepped for it and if you're not ready for it, it can be quite a disconcerting situation to be in. And but you kind of almost then escalate your behavior and start to be like, I want to hold the paw because I do want to check for grass seeds or yeah. trim the nails or whatever it might be. And it very quickly, like you say, it kind of erodes that trust pretty fast if it goes too quick.
Yeah, that is one of the other things we do as humans, is if something pulls away, our natural instinct is to grip on harder. so yeah, it's learning to almost change your own behavior a little bit so that you can approach it easier. But once the dog has learned to accept it, that's when we can start building resilience and increasing our pressure, if you like, increasing how firmly we're holding on to them. Because don't forget, whatever we do, they're our animals, and we're going to be gentle and cautious when we're doing this process. But when they're going to the vets have got potentially only 10 to 15 minutes to get them in and out and to get it done. So really, it's our responsibility as owners to be preparing our dogs for that event and making sure they're resilient to it and can bounce back. Yes, potentially they're going to get stressed whilst they're there. They're going to get a bit uncomfortable, but it's a recovery. We want to try and teach them so they can recover from that and they don't need to hold on to that stress.
That's absolutely massive, definitely, because it's... I know from personal experience, Betty Boo, one of my rescue sheps, she had quite, my vets are absolutely fantastic. This is not a slight on my vets at all, but she went in for a spay and there was some trouble finding one of the ovaries, didn't think she had one. So kind of stitched up, came home, recovered. Long story short, she ended up having to go back in for a second spay. Good job she did, because they found it thanks to a growth, and obviously that was benign, so everything was fab that way. But those two events alone have completely changed her acceptance of going to the vets. And the yeah. first one was kind of all right. She kind of bounced back a little and she was okay going for weighs and stitches out and things like that. after the second one and the second lot of surgery, she's, yeah, we've effectively gone right back to square one now to build all that back up, getting her comfortable with even just me kind of touching her, kind of around her tummy and her belly and stuff. It can be that a real roller coaster to really build that trust and resilience back up again and again, particularly if your dog has gone through a number of procedures or suffers an ongoing illness.
Absolutely. And then we also have to take into account the dog's individual personality. So I've got three dogs here at home, and unfortunately, I think it is vet nurse luck that they all have had issues. The dog that I know that your listeners can't see, but the dog that is bugging me in the background the most for attention, unfortunately, she's plagued with allergies and she's been in and out of the vets a lot. And she's also the most sensitive dog. So it's a complete roller coaster with her. But if I hadn't done the work for her as a puppy, she would be even worse. It would be even more difficult for her to cope with that vet taking her away from me and to be examined and things like that. My oldest dog, unfortunately, she's been very well trained and she's always been a lot more resilient in general. She came from a very big litter of puppies as well. So she, for example, had a grass seed in her foot one day, and because she's been taught cooperative care and handling, the vet was able to inject her with local anaesthetic and fish about in her foot with her standing nicely, waiting, holding her paw out. But my other dog would not have been able to do that because she's not resilient enough in her demeanour. Yeah. But the older dog then has ended up in referral for some procedures, and she has to have blood tests regularly. So we have definitely lost some of those trust points. I'm not so much, but the vet, yeah, so she always loved the vet, licked the vet, but now she's a little bit like, I'm not so sure. But because she is more resilient, we don't have any refusal behaviors to go into the vets or anything like that, like potentially a more sensitive dog would do. But it is, so we have to consider always the individual animal. So I guess that brings us back to the different sort of approaches. So generally, you've probably covered this if you've done cooperative care before, but it is that
go for it, do it again.
Building up that really nice experience with being touched, being handled, and then once you've built sort of a base of behaviours for that, building up the pressure. So for cooperative care, for example, you can teach them to come around and have their head lifted up through targeting, and teaching them to be gripped, you know, nice and firmly, as they would be if they were in the vets having a blood test. And even for my big dog that's got the allergies, you know, she's a 40 kilo dog. If she needs to have bloods done, that takes at least three people to hold on to her. So if you're going to try and build resilience for things like that, you'll also have to incorporate helpers, which at the moment is very tricky unless you've got quite a busy household. But you can still do all the prep work at least and create that base behaviour. But if you've got an older dog that already doesn't like, you know, if you haven't got a puppy that's coming to you fresh, you're going to have to take it much slower and maybe be more clever with your training and rely on targeting more often. So a nifty trick that I've always used over the years with patients that didn't like coming into the vets is just to teach them a really good bed exercise. If the owner teaches that themselves, they can bring in their own blanket. The dog's got some familiarity when they go into that room, or something with their own scent on, something that's got a really strong reward history attached to it. And they can do a down on the bed, for example. And that in itself can help just to keep them a little less stressed if we can. Again, obviously, it depends on the individual dog, but that's worked really successfully. So just getting a little bit clever. And, you know, generally vets, if you say to them, my dog needs a bit of extra time, you can try and book a longer appointment to account for that. You can take in those sorts of things. Or if you've got a dog that potentially is going to change very quickly and bite them, or try to bite, which obviously we don't want ideally, but even down to muzzle training, because it's again building familiarity. So when the dog goes into the vets not having this really foreign thing just slung on their face, the amount of dogs that get really, really stressed out from having to wear a muzzle is quite amazing. So Yeah, so just doing some of those things, or even if your dog doesn't have that level of stress, just getting used to being muzzle trained just in case is really helpful. Again, just so that it's not just some other foreign thing that's going to freak them out. And like you touched on earlier, desensitization to grooming equipment, that can help prepare them for clippers even, because it's a strange looking object. And you can go as far as buying your own clippers and getting your dog used to that noise. When I'm working with students in classes, for example, we'll just use our mobile phones. You can really easily get apps with clipper noises on, and it'll make your phone vibrate at the same time. So it's really easy to just start getting animals used to it, you know?
That's what a fantastic idea. That is, I absolutely love that. Because I've come across things like using pens and even going to kind of the extremities of kind of cocktail sticks and things like that to kind of get used, kind of, again, after you've gone through all the elements you've already mentioned there. But to, again, just kind of getting them used to strange objects, kind of prodding them, poking them, injections, etc. It's and I think that the bit that you touched on there, which I really liked, is that it's very easy to get a bit complacent if your dog doesn't have a big dramatic reaction to the vets. And even though they may be uncomfortable, if they're not in a state that's overly overt to or obvious to us, it can, like you say, you just kind of just, I think they're fine with it and I'm just going to carry on, where it's that in itself almost should be a trigger to go, I still should do a bit of this just to help bomb-proof that behavior even more. And just like you said, build that resiliency, because even if your dog does look okay or appears, the you know, that infamous appears fine with the vets, that still shouldn't be a get out of jail free card. It still should kind of want us to carry on that cooperative care work.
Exactly. And don't forget that only people that are really trained enough to determine if a dog would be fine would be really a behaviorist. Vets aren't trained in reading body language, and nor are owners unless they've worked with a professional before. I can't talk about it too much, but I did some research for my master's degree looking at stress behaviors in dogs. And every single dog that came in displayed stress behaviors, regardless of their personality. Obviously, the more resilient the dog was, the less that they displayed, but every single dog displayed at least one or two stress behaviors. So that was really interesting. So my dog is fine, as is a very sweeping generalized statement that I would argue is untrue.
I kind of definitely agree, because like I say, even like my older Cavi, bless her, she's so kind of placid, it's a meaner anyway, but you can see like she loves cuddles, she loves being handled, but again, it's very much when it's on her terms. So if she's thrust in the vet situation, she's on the table and somebody's coming over to manhandle her, you can see I think the word I'd probably use is she's accepting of it, but she's not enjoying it. And then obviously, like you said earlier on, there's elements of veterinary stuff that in the nicest way isn't going to be enjoyable because of the nature of what it is. But it can be such a false sense of security to fall into when you think your dog is okay or fine or whatever label we put on it. But in reality, like you say, of course it's not. In the same way that I can go to the dentist and generally I'm fine going to the dentist, but there's always an element of a slightly knotty stomach or that smell or whatever it is that when I walk in that instantly just probably raises my heart rate a little bit more than it probably was before I walked in.
Yeah, exactly. And the smell is something else that you can actually help dogs with, because most of the products that vets use, you can buy. So if you wanted to The two most common things used in practice are surgical spirit and hibiscus. Well, you can buy them over the counter or on Amazon really easily. So if you want to desensitize your dog to those smells, then do it. You know, you can do
I didn't even think. I always am aware of smell, obviously, in vets, and probably more from the other dog perspective rather than the actual vet smell. But yeah, I didn't even know. What a great idea that is. I absolutely love that.
Yeah. The only other thing normally is their cleaning product, but you could just ask them what they use, and if you can't buy it, you know, they might be willing to give you a little sample pot just so you can use that to get them used to the smell. So it's tricky to get dogs used to the vets, because we can't recreate the vet environment at home, But if we break it down and look at all the different elements that there are at a vet's, we can work on that. Yeah, we can look at all those different things. For some dogs that are already worried about the vets, the building itself is a trigger. So that would mean work on parking opposite the building or further away even. You know, some research just suggests that dogs know when they're going to the vets and they start to become stressed before they leave or even in the car journey. I would suspect that the owner is acting slightly differently and has built some kind of association with that. So then we need to be looking at what our habits are and getting our dogs used to those habits. And I've had clients in the past that have literally just done drive-bys and not stopped or anything because the dog needs to just reduce their reactions. So we just have to have a look at what each individual dog's issue is. There's already one, and then just break it down into its different components.
Yeah, I'm doing that with Betty at the moment. As I mentioned, my Betty, obviously, again, part of her kind of work to build that trust back is very much she will come along for little rides out. So, for example, my older cabbie, she's on some medication now. So if I go and get a prescription, Betty will come along for the ride. Sometimes she stays in the van. Sometimes she comes out and walks to the door for me to collect the prescription. Then we walk back to the van. So even though it's, let's be honest, it's a slight inconvenience for me because it takes longer than it would be if I just pulled up in the car. I know obviously it's going to be much beneficial for her because she's having lots of these little nice little successful sessions of going to the environment, but with nothing else happening other than a few treats, some rewards for being fantastically calm, and then kind of heading back out. There was a bit you've mentioned a few times, Kate, which I'd love to build on, is that kind of discussion with vets. So I know you mentioned about kind of speaking to them about your kind of dog's kind of general personality and demeanor and kind of different slots and, you know, what types of equipment and cleaning products do they use. I don't know if I'm fortunate or not, whether this is standard across all vet practices, but I love talking to my vets because they do always engage in that dialogue. If I've got strange questions or weird asks because of, again, Betty being a prime example, like when she goes, I'm kind of saying, you know, she's not great anymore. She's muzzle trained, so she'll come on a muzzle and this kind of stuff. She'll have a high vis on and various other bits. And they're very receptive of that. And is that probably a fair statement of quite a lot of vets? If you actually have that dialogue with them and explain what your dog is like, that they'll kind of...
Ultimately, the vet's job is much easier if, one, your dog is used to it, or two, you pre-warn them. The worst kind of situation to be in is being told, oh, my dog is fine, and then for a staff member to end up getting bitten, only notes back 2 years before to see that the dog has actually bitten or tried to bite before. So honesty is key. Obviously, there's times, especially during the pandemic, that the vets have been a lot more stretched. So it might be harder for them to accommodate each individual person's animal's needs as well. But if a vet practice can help an owner with their animal, I'm pretty sure that the majority will, because it ultimately just makes everything easier. You can't care for an animal properly if they're having a stay in hospital, if they're really stressed out and don't like to be handled. So everything's just going to be better for that animal if they get used to it. And just touching back on one thing, which I know is a bit like Marmite, is crate training. So people either love it or hate it. But in practice, you can generally tell which dogs are crate trained because they'll sit in the kennel a lot easier. So even if you don't really like crates or the idea of them, at some point, again, your dog is going to have a stay in hospital and they will be restrained via a crate or a cage. So even getting them used to that segregation is going to make it so much easier for them whilst they're in that hospital.
Massively. I do. I think muzzles, crates, kind of, I call them buster collars. I'm not sure if they've got a proper name other than that, but those types of things, like you say, for that reason is why I'm a huge fan of kind of training them or educating people around why they're so beneficial to learn and do some work around. Because it's, regardless of whether you're going to use it day to day, having some learnt history is better than none, and going into those environments where those things might become part of the dog's life for a short period is definitely going to be a benefit for them.
Yeah. And what generally what you find is if you've managed to train for resilience and you've created like habituation and you've started training for resilience, if you've forgotten an odd object, you know, you've left that off by accident, generally they'll get used to it quicker because they've got that kind of history and they recover quicker from the initial stress reaction and settle down. So yeah, so all those sorts of things, buster collars, bandages, you know, if we wanted to do it properly, that in itself probably would be a full-time program without doing training our fake behaviors like walking on the lead and sit and, you know, that kind of thing. So yeah,
it's so universal, though, and I think again, the grooming podcast that I did, and I think this is where there is a lot of that crossover with that cooperative care and that handling, because even silly things like drying paws on a towel after a wet or a slushy walk or whatever, or grooming brushes or anything like that, there's so much crossover. If your dog is comfortable and knows kind of what the expectation is and how to handle themselves and how to deal with those situations, those things are things you're going to use pretty much, certainly in England, most days of your life, particularly the towel one. It's so again, yeah, that is a real life skill that is definitely, it's so valuable. It's much better than chasing your dog around the house trying to dry them off. And then same grass seeds, nail clippings, potentially, you know, like say, kind of taking blood or anything like that in the vets. It's kind of all in that same kind of overall arching banner of that kind of cooperative care and handling. So it's just, like I say, spending the time and effort, even though you think your recall might be more important, you're probably going to spend more time doing the handling stuff than you are anything else.
Yeah, exactly. Just bear with me one moment.
All right, no problem.
Got some dogs having a bit of a chat in the background and it can get noisy. It's like just started, but if I don't intervene, it'll get noisy and then you won't have to hear me.
It's probably a perfect time to ask if you're happy to share. Do you mind if I ask, and again, for the benefit of those listening, kind of what dogs you've got and who they are?
Okay. All right. Yeah. So I have Italian Spinonis. And actually, it coincides with, I got my first Spinoni in like 2001 and quickly realized that one had a dog with lots of health issues, unfortunately. So I started learning all about health stuff. It's when I got my first job in the vets, because I was there literally every week with him. So I ended up working there. And then he had loads of behavior issues. So I started learning all about dog behavior, health, and there has always been a massive crossover, and I weren't content with learning about one thing. So I was going to say,
to be an RVN and to do a master's, that's definitely a lot of study and a lot of commitment to the course.
Yeah, so thanks to him, I've got a like diploma basically now, would be the equivalent, because it's so long ago, it's kind of not a qualification that's used anymore, but a diploma in behaviour and training. I've now got 2 degrees in behaviour and training, my vet nursing. I'm a certified behaviour adjustment training instructor with Grisha Stewart.
I'm jealous now.
I've ended up doing quite a lot, and it's all really thanks to him. I always had dogs and animals growing up, and there's probably only a couple of years in my life where I didn't think I would be working with animals, but I ended up working with animals. At the moment I have 3 Italian Spinonis. The most I've had are 5 all in one go. But 3 is enough now, because of course the insurance has increased quite a lot in the last few years.
Yes.
So although I liked having 5, I financially can't afford it because they do unfortunately end up with all these weird and wonderful health issues. I've got a mum and a daughter. So the oldest and the youngest are mum and daughter. And then my middle one, who you saw, Nella, the middle one, she's only a year older than the youngest one, and it's actually her birthday tomorrow. She's going to be 7 tomorrow.
Oh well, happy birthday for tomorrow then. I hope you're having like the big kind of lockdown party for them and kind of making the most of it.
She's got a lovely new toy waiting for her. But I'm going to take her out on a solo walk, and she's got a new toy that my friend recommended for her. Wow. So because we've got so many toys, and I'm like, you know, all the normal things we've got already. So yeah, Nella's the middle one. Brooke is my eldest, and she's going to be 10 this year. And then I've got Oriana, who is going to be 6 soon. So yeah.
Fantastic. I mean, they are beautiful, obviously. If you're happy to, I'll share your social media pages and things, because obviously I know you do put pictures up of them, and they are absolutely gorgeous. So yeah. What a lovely breed. And quite, am I right in thinking that they're a fairly rare breed in the UK? I certainly don't see a lot of them up north.
Yeah, they're not. So I do, we do work. We live in Norfolk. It's very rural. The reason I ended up with 5 is that every dog that I got that was supposed to be my working dog ended up with something significant that meant they couldn't be a working dog. So only my youngest is actually a proper working dog during season. For that reason, I do have separate social media channels, because I know some people don't really like everything that comes along with working things. So yeah, they are pretty rare. They're not the most popular of breeds for working, because you can't necessarily train them as quickly. Unfortunately, in the gun dog world, harsh handling is very prolific still, and they don't respond very well as a breed to harsh handling. So they're not as popular. They're not quick like breeds like German Shorthair Pointers. So they're a hunt point retrieve breed. So for your traditional gun dog people, you know, they're going to be wanting your Labradors and Spaniels. And for HPR people, they generally go with German breeds. Or the Hungarian breeds are quite popular now. So yeah, they're less common, but their popularity has soared during lockdown. They're not, HPRs in general are not the most easiest of dogs, because they have a very strong hunting instinct and, you know, prey drive. So they're not always the most easiest. But yeah, so that's kind of why. They're not that hard to get hold of. Not that easy, sorry, to get hold of if you do decide you want one. I think the waiting list for a puppy probably is about 2 years at the moment because of lockdown.
Yeah, and again, obviously, like I said, obviously finding suitable breeders and everything else, obviously that's a challenge in itself. But yeah, no, they're absolutely stunning dogs. And like I said, they're not one that you do see a lot of kind of generally in life. So it's, I do absolutely love seeing the pictures of yours when they pop up. They're absolutely stunning.
I should probably tell you as well, I also have 2 cats.
I don't judge, it's fine.
And I have a snake and a tortoise.
All right, wow. Oh, what snake have you got?
Just a corn snake that was a rescue from work. It's the only things I've ever brought home from practice is a snake. I've been very good with dogs, puppies and cats. But over the years, I've hand-reared quite a lot of birds and hedgehogs. I really like hedgehogs.
The wife and I have been on a mission the past kind of year to try and improve our hedgehog awareness and like kind of garden compatibility and things like that. Because it's, like everything, isn't it? The more you learn, the more you realize kind of what the world's like around you, and you try and modify your behavior to make a little bit of a difference. But yeah, I don't think I could work in a veterinary practice for that reason. The same way that even though I do charity work for a number of dogs, kennel work, I think would just, I don't think I've got the emotional kind of bandwidth to deal with that much heartbreak.
It's really hard. It's very easy to get stressed and burnout. And I hope you don't mind touching on that note. Obviously, vets do take a lot of flack sometimes. And suicide is at one of the highest rates out of any profession in the veterinary industry.
Wow.
Because of the kind of emotional tie that's to it. And then you also have the impact of Facebook groups berating vets and all of those kinds of things that go with it. So be kind to your vets. They are always under a hell of a lot of pressure. You know, they have literally 10 to 15 minutes to do their job, basically, and get to the next one. So I know sometimes it's very stressful for us as owners, very emotional for us if our animals are unwell. But yeah, I don't think it's very well known about the suicide rate in the veterinary industry.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of that at all. I mean, I certainly, again, picking on my vets again, but I've seen obviously kind of what they've been through during lockdown, and obviously with me having my elderly pooch who's not been obviously too well when she got diagnosed with heart issues. I did have 2 cabbies and we lost one just over a year ago. So I obviously, like a lot of us, I kind of stick with the same vet and all that kind of stuff. And during obviously lockdown, obviously they went to like skeleton staff, and he was part of that skeleton staff doing unbelievable hours and unbelievable shifts without days off for literally months. And you know, you could see the poor guy was obviously, you know, burning out, for want of a better description. And but yeah, it's like you say, there's groups and there's media and there's things out there that do give it a hard time. I've never quite understood it, because like you say, the work that people do, whether you're a veterinary nurse, reception, a vet, every aspect of that kind of industry is immensely busy. And like you say, it's not all rainbows and nice stuff, is it? You are dealing with people and dogs in situations that are often quite horrific or traumatic or stressful or upsetting. And that time and time again, even in one day, let alone weeks and weeks, months and months, is emotional toll that must take. Must be pretty intense.
Yeah, it's very intense. Very intense, unfortunately. There have been a couple of campaigns this year, but I think it's hard to get that out to the general public, you know, for that mental health awareness side of things for the profession. But yeah, very, very hard. I'd probably say that in a day of working at the vets, there's probably not, you probably don't get any days where you're not feeling stressed out and or anxious or had someone shout at you or something like that, you know. So yes, you have to
be nice to vets and all the veterinary staff.
Yeah, so please be kind to your veterinary staff from all levels, be it the admin staff, the receptionist. The receptionists get the brunt of it sometimes from all angles, because an owner might be shouting at them, they might be relaying the message and then getting not
the vet response
from the other end. Yeah. So yeah, be kind. They appreciate treats, especially during lockdown.
I must admit, Merlin was a year ago in January. Yeah, so we, I don't know why. I think it's a life thing, isn't it? Kind of being nice and courteous and respectful of each other's. Obviously, I think it goes throughout life. But yeah, with anyone who has an interest in looking after my animals as much as I do, for me, definitely kind of deserve praise, reward, chocolates, coffee, whatever it is I can drop off that helps them get through the days is definitely something I'm happy to do.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's really appreciated. Any of those little things is always really appreciated by the veterinary staff.
That's fab. So just thinking, obviously, we've talked a lot about kind of that preparation and the planning and the cooperative care and the handling side of things. But obviously, once you've gone through all that, obviously, we still do have to go to the vets, and there will be vet visits that you've got to partake, whether it's health checks or otherwise. Is there any kind of things that you've encountered or kind of top tips that you would give in terms of what to think about as kind of a person rocking up to a veterinary surgery with a dog?
Yeah, so first of all, unless your dog is very resilient, and you've got a very nice waiting room, unfortunately a lot of vets have really tiny waiting rooms, yeah? So if your dog looks like they're starting to be a bit stressed even before going in, I'd advise not to go in to the actual waiting room. Leave the dog in the car, pop in, tell them you're there, and then just wait nearby so that they haven't got to come looking for you, but so that they can shout from the door or something. But just don't go in the waiting room. You know, if your dog is sitting there, especially if the vet's running behind, you know, 5, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, the longer they sit there, the more stressed out they're going to get, you know, before they've even gone in and been pulled about. So the first thing I would be is, like, be aware of your environment. Or if your dog is okay but maybe is a bit sensitive to other dogs, have a look who's in the waiting room. You know, a lot of owners have this real thing about taking their dogs in the waiting room, even if they've got dog-to-dog issues, and you'll have a dog sitting in the waiting room that's growling or barking or even lunging at other dogs. That's not really ideal for that dog or for the other patients that are inside the building, because quite often even the consulting rooms are straight off of the waiting room. So those dogs in those consulting rooms can hear that happening and can start to get, you know, upset because of the noises that they can hear. So if you've got a dog that's going to be like that, stay outside with them. Or if you arrive and you see a dog like that in the waiting room, stay outside with your dog. You know, don't expose your dog to that level of anxiety before they've even gone in. So that would be the first thing. I see quite a lot as well, dogs that are worried to go in the vets and are pretty much forced, you know, dragged over the threshold of the door. Again, you know, it really doesn't matter to your vet if you wait outside. Your vet's going to prefer it if your dog doesn't go into the room or head up,
yeah,
you know, before they've even touched them, because they're potentially going to get stressed enough as soon as they're in the room. So that would be my top tip. People are always surprised about that, about waiting outside, but it's like the easiest thing you can do to help your dog out.
And I mean, I'm a big believer in prevention rather than cure with a lot of things when it comes to training and behavior. And even that, like I said, it makes perfect sense, totally logical. But like you say, how many of us actually give that forethought? Because you think, well, my dog is going to the vets, therefore my dog is going in the vets. But like you say, in reality, yeah, it's a human who checks in and lets know that they're there. The dog doesn't need to do any of that. It's just going to go into the examination room or the treatment room whenever that time comes. So yeah, and I loved how you kind of flipped it from both sides. Because like you say, as if there's one of those types of dogs in the waiting room, I've got one, so I know exactly what it's like to be on both sides of that fence of holding one, and also kind of walking in when there is one who isn't a fan of either the vets or other dogs, or even, like say, the other animals that go into vets, you know, rabbits, cats, anything else that comes in there. Some of those might be incredibly novel for a lot of dogs and almost exciting. So it might not even be kind of nerves or anxiety. It might be pure excitement of the stimulation of everything that's around them. And if that's just going to, like you say, hate your dog up to a point of becoming not quite unmanageable, some dogs may become unmanageable, but certainly putting them in a higher state of kind of arousal before they get there, you know, that's
definitely,
if you just avoid it by leaving them in the car or whatever, obviously safely, that's always going to be interesting.
Yeah, my vets, luckily, when they, obviously during COVID, the vets aren't, you know, waiting rooms aren't open, but my vets are, luckily I have a very large waiting room, so cats and small animals stay at one side and dogs the other. So that's better for dogs and small animals because they're not getting stressed out seeing each other. But you're right, you know, the amount of times that I've seen people in a queue at the vets waiting to pay, someone's got their cat carrier, someone behind's with a dog, and the dog is poking the carrier, you know, both those animals are going to be getting stressed out. So on the flip side, when you come out, go put your dog in the car, you know, then come back. Unless you've got a pretty resilient and well-trained dog that can sort of wait quite nicely in the queue, go put your dog in the car and then come back. It's going to be better for everyone. Because like you say, prevention is better than cure. And we want to, as much as possible, have really positive experiences at the vets. If a cat starts really hissing and growling at a dog, that's going to wind the dog up more. Carriers sometimes break, you know, cats do escape sometimes in the vets. You know, that would be a recipe for disaster, you know, if a dog was nearby. So yeah, it's kind of being mindful, I suppose, not just of your own situation, but of the other animals that are around there.
Yeah, definitely. Do you see anything in terms of, I suppose it probably comes in, because obviously you've not just got the physical acts of those dogs or the other animals obviously getting excited and the sounds that come with it. I imagine obviously there's an olfactory, there's a smell element there as well, obviously kind of that's going to just kind of permeate around that room that might be obviously completely blissfully unaware from our perspective. But for those animals in the clinic, I imagine that's something they tune into pretty quick.
Yeah, so that's one of the only things we can't really help with when we're doing preparatory work, is the pheromones that are going to be around in the environment. And obviously the higher number of animals that have gone in that are stressed, the more that is that pheromone level is going to be increased. So a lot of vets really are kind of getting on board with that now as well, which is where the split waiting room idea comes from, to try and reduce that amount of stress for patients that are waiting to go in. Some new vets that are purpose built have separate cat and dog wards. A nice vet that I locumed at, they've got a cat ward and exotics ward for reptiles and small furries, and a separate dog ward. So vets that are sort of new now and buildings for the reason of vets have really started to think about those kinds of things and just to try to keep the animals as comfortable as possible, really.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And again, I think that's really key, isn't it? Because my vet is in a very old building. So, like you said, the space issue is absolutely huge there. They do a fantastic job of managing it, but you can only work with what you've got, haven't you? So, yeah again, you know, there's four people in that waiting room and it's pretty packed. There's not a lot of room to maneuver. And like you say, even that in itself can be a lot for people, let alone dogs or any of the animals that are there.
Yeah, so... if like yourself, if you've got a shepherd, right, you said, so if you've got a large breed and your vet's waiting room is really tiny, there's probably no point going in there, because even if your dog's really good, there could be something in there that's not happy, and it wouldn't take a lot for maybe your dog's tail to get chomped on or something. So yeah, it's all those little considerations, really. And if your dog's not happy about waiting in the car, you can always call your vets to tell them, I'm here, but I'm outside.
Yeah, yeah, of course, yeah. I'd say that whole prevention kind of mentality, it's that forethought, isn't it? And I think that planning to just think, I'm going to do that, because it is just, for me anyway, when I go to appointments, I've got somewhere to be at a certain time. I get there, jump out the car, rock into the whatever it is that I've gone into. And I think vets generally falls into that category, as if I was going to the dentist or the doctors or wherever it might be. And actually, when, like you say, when the animals are involved, I've got somebody else I need to think about, or another creature I need to think about, and the others that are also in that environment as well.
Yeah, so I think actually you've just made me think of something else that's quite important, is make sure you're allowing enough time. And you'd be surprised the amount of people that rock up late to their vet appointment, or just right on the nose, you know, they're arriving at the time they should be going into the room. And if you as an owner are in a rush, you're going to be rushing your animal as well. So allow that bit of extra time in case it's traffic. Allow yourselves a good 10 minutes before your appointment is actually going to go ahead to tell them you're there and, you know, get your dog settled. Especially if you're going to be waiting outside, because then you've got the time to go in, tell them you're here, come back out, get anything you need for your appointment. If you've took treats with you, that's the other thing as well. Make sure you take really nice, yummy treats. The vets will have some, but they're normally, not all vets will have yummy treats, you know. Take really high value treats with you. Again, it just helps to bolster that really positive association with the vets. And I think the one thing is not necessarily making your vet give the dog a treat, because we get stuck in that cycle of approach avoidance conflict, you know, from the dog. If they're not really that keen, but they're quite food driven, they're going to then put themselves potentially in a situation where they want the food, but they don't really want to go near the vet. And again, vets aren't trained, unless they've got a special interest in behavior, they're not going to understand the nuances of the behavior. So you as the owner should be the one feeding, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's a really, really good advice. So like I say, it's a different relationship and a different dynamic, isn't it? So, and sometimes it's good to kind of keep, I don't know if boundaries is the right word, but certainly keep those expectations per person kind of aligned properly. So again, you're not confusing or creating any conflict for your dog. That's fun. Kate, that's fantastic. There's so much stuff there. So I've been kind of scribbling notes as we've gone to see if we can cover a couple of real big call outs to cover off. But obviously that kind of cooperative care, handling and spending the time and effort with your dog, either right from day one as a puppy, or potentially even more time if it's a rescue or a dog that's kind of come into your home where you don't really know their history that well, and spending that time really going through that. And I know there's amazing resources online. I'm fairly sure you'll have some as well. So I will make sure I pop your details on the show notes for those. But that's definitely obviously one huge takeaway in terms of preparation for going to the vet. I think, again, one of the biggest ones, kind of talking to your vet, having that dialogue, being nice, kind of just, you know, understanding their working parameters, their expectations, and obviously in educating them on your dog, can obviously just remove a lot of that stress and the drama away from a lot of the visits. That mindfulness and that understanding of the process of signing in and where to keep my dog and what might be going on in the waiting room area, and just taking some nice easy prevention steps to avoid any of that even ever becoming an issue for you or the other animals in the vets. Timekeeping, Definitely, always a good one. I'm a stickler for that. If you're on time, you're late, I think was the mentality that I grew up with. So definitely do that with the vets. And those high value rewards, yeah, it's so easy just to get everything head to the vets and totally forget that, you know, like you say, you want to pair it with some positive experiences. And if that's some of amazing high quality food with you, then yeah, it's a bit of a no-brainer, really.
Yeah. Or for some dogs, obviously, they might be more toy driven. So, you know, whatever works for your dog.
Yeah.
I think on one point of that with the food as well, a good test that I always say to people is, especially at the vets, if your dog refuses food, they're over their tolerance threshold, is a very good indication. And circling back to when my dog's fine, if your dog won't take a treat, especially a high value treat, they definitely aren't fine. But of course, flooding happens so easily at a vet. So it's possible that your dog is shut down. And that's why they're not displaying any obvious behavior, but refusal to eat is a very strong indication they are not okay.
Yeah. And I think that, and if you don't mind, just touching on that flooding really quickly, because again, it's what we see as the as a human, it's like you say, it can be misconstrued as good behavior. Dog isn't doing anything, they're just there. They're not reacting, they're not barking, they're not really moving around or fidgeting too much. They're just kind of frozen in spot, potentially being a very good boy or very good girl. Like you say, for some dogs, that actually isn't the case, and they're in a state that is really not nice for them to be in.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something that's seen more so when they're put on the table, because there is no means of escape versus on the floor, there's more opportunity. So yeah, that perception of they're absolutely fine, but we need to be taking into account the whole animal, you know, what was their towel and ear set prior to being lifted up onto the table or being touched versus now. Most dogs are, like I said, going to display stress behaviours. We'd probably only say there's a small minority of dogs that are actually bomb-proof with people and don't care about where they're touched, what's touched. But as soon as you get to a painful area, they are going to change their demeanor if they're in there for a health reason rather than preventative. So yeah, I mean, some dogs, like my, you know, Talon Spinoni, they don't even flinch for injections, they don't feel it, they've got such thick skin. But then you take in a small breed like a Chihuahua who's got quite tight skin, they're going to feel an injection. So you have to, again, consideration for each personality and breed and things like that.
Definitely. And it just kind of, then you just go back full circle, don't you, to that familiarization with equipment and understanding. And yeah, it's just, I mean, it's so obvious when you talk about it, but it's so easy to overlook it when it's not at the first kind of forefront of your mind when you're working or you've got a pooch in your life and you think, what's the stuff I want to train with it? And like you say, we do tend to go down more towards those other skills that absolutely benefit in walks and being outdoors and stuff. But actually the time when I really want my dog to be pretty well versed and fairly resilient to situations is going to be those ones where they're going to be handled quite heavily, more than likely in the vets.
Yeah. I think something else that's always, I don't think you ever get used to it at vet practice really, is when an owner brings their dog in for you to do something to them because they can't. And they think that because they can't, you will be able to. Yeah. So like claw clips, for example, cleaning ears. A lot of owners assume because it's a vet professional that they're going to be able to do it. But obviously, if a pet isn't comfortable with the owner doing it, it's going to be very stressful for a vet to try to do it. So it all, that falls back, you know, the responsibility falls back to the owner. It's the owner's responsibility. And I think ears are something that owners neglect because a lot of dogs potentially aren't going to have their ears touched until they've got an ear infection or inflammation, and then it's painful. We should be doing mock ear cleaning, even if we don't need to, even if it's just with water, to make sure that the animal is used to having their ears, having weird liquid in their ears and, you know, all those kinds of things that people don't think about doing, and they only start doing it when the problem is already there, the health issue is already present. So,
yeah, like you say, the discomfort level or even the pain level there is just going to be amplified, which means appetite to stomach it or to sustain it's just obviously going to fall off a cliff, isn't it? But that's, do you know what? I've never, ever thought of You hear about people going to the vets to get nails clipped, etc., but I've never quite kind of joined the dots there around it's because I can't do it for my dog, therefore I need a vet to support me. In that context of, yeah, absolutely, if you can't do it, like effectively take them to a stranger or somebody they only see once in a blue moon. That's a very very intense situation to take your dog into if they won't even do it with you, who they're, you know, they spend 99% of their life with.
Yeah, it's always a tricky one, and obviously you do get used to lots of different things when you're working with people in general, but that's the kind of thing that always you think you, I don't think you ever get used to that thought process, you know. Obviously some owners are taking their pets to have their claw clips done quite regular as well, because a lot of vets now offer health schemes where you get your claw clips as part of the deal. But yeah, you still are getting those ones that they just can't do it. And normally if they haven't been able to do it themselves, they come in and the claws are curled into the feet, you know. So we've got that pain level again, it's increased. We're now going to have to wash their feet. They're probably going to have to have antibiotics because they've got pad infection. You know, so the whole event is just very traumatic for everybody, not just the dog.
Yeah, definitely. And again, I suppose, and I think going back to obviously that whole premise of talking to your vet, particularly if you've got a situation where, I think the only way to describe it is probably you might feel a bit embarrassed. Like, I know with Betty Boo, and you know, I'm a dog trainer, and she's not great with other dogs, and it hasn't been since. I mean, she's a lot better than she was, but she, you know, she has a tolerance level. It's probably not as wide as most other dogs, and that conversation, it could be very embarrassing to pick up the phone and kind of say to my vet, you know, hi, it's, you know, it's Greg, it's the dog trainer with the, you know, the dog that doesn't like other dogs. Kind of, can I come for an appointment? But I need to be later in the day, or I need longer, or whatever it might be. For me, from a personal pride and an embarrassment perspective, that can be quite massive. So I think thinking of claws and curling in, and so I imagine a lot of that stuff is probably born out of that element of you don't want to be, nobody wants to be a kind of bad parent for the dogs. So you almost, dare I say, kind of potentially run the risk of putting things off of the fear of having what could be a difficult or an embarrassing conversation where, as we've talked about already, actually just being honest and upfront and considerate right from the start usually will avoid most of the issues anyway.
I think there's actually two issues. One is the embarrassment factor. Although I think when it comes to the vet-owner relationship, owners seem to be a little bit more honest with the vets than potentially behaviourists. You know, if they've got a behaviour issue, it's quite often the vet they'll call first because they don't really know what else to do. Sometimes they have left it until it's really awful, obviously. But other times they're just looking for that advice. And I think the other thing, particularly when it comes to claw health or ear health, is that we haven't trained owners enough to be doing those regular checks at least weekly. So until the dog starts to maybe walk a bit strange, or if you've got carpet and the claws start to catch in the carpet, that's what makes owners think, oh, what's wrong with you? Let's have a look. Try to have a look. It's really hard because they haven't got their dog used to having their feet touch. So we kind of get stuck in this really vicious circle of, because they haven't done the habituation and resilience, they don't pick up on issues sooner. That makes the issue become quite a problem before it's noticed. The animals are very good at suppressing ill health and problems. So it's only obvious to the owner when it really is an issue. And of course, by then the animal will be maybe have an infection or have pain. So it just makes the whole problem a lot worse. So it goes back to maintenance. Once we've built that resilience, we need to maintain it, so that we can be keeping an eye on our pets and helping them sooner to reduce that level of illness that then can happen.
Yeah, definitely. My mind's already whizzing now with loads of things I want to go and start doing more of with my dog, because I'm thinking, they're probably as good as that as I'd like to think they are. Probably they're not. Maybe some extra homework is going to join my training sheet.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. Like I said, if we all did it properly, we wouldn't have time for, in my opinion, we wouldn't have time for all the other stuff.
It's but like you say, something is better than nothing, isn't it? So it
yeah, just, exactly.
Those little 5-minute sessions, even if it's once a week, is going to be so much better for your animal than nothing whatsoever for months or weeks or years, depending on what it could be. So that's been. I've absolutely loved this, Katie. Thank you so much for coming along. I hope we can have a follow-up, because it'd be great to kind of do the latter part. So kind of, you know, kind of the end of the vet appointment and aftercare and that kind of stuff would be a fantastic follow-up if you're up for it one time.
Yeah, of course. No problem.
Brilliant. But before we do end, do you want to give yourself a bit of a plug? Is there anything that you want to share? Websites, courses, anything you like? The metaphorical floor is yours if there's anything you want to share.
Okay, thank you very much. I have quite a few different things that I'm involved with because I have many interests, as it may have come across. So I do offer remote learning. One of my passions is positive gun dog training. So I do clicker work with my gun dogs, and I do have an online course for that as well. I have actually done a small online course for Grecia Stewart, which is on her platform, where I do go into more particular steps. So that might be useful for people if they want to have a look at that. But basically everything is on my website, which is katiealdred.co.uk. If you navigate over there, I've got some blog posts as well that people might find useful. And just to be very specific, my name is spelled K-A-T-E-Y. Otherwise you might not find me. My dog training club is called Pooch Paws. So if you do have any issues finding me or trying to get in touch with me, you can find me at Pooch Paws as well. So I have quite a different range of things that I do with people.
Oh, that's that Grecia Stewart one sounds fantastic. I'm I'm always eyeing up bat courses, and I'm like, that's definitely on the wish list for me personally. But I'll pop all the links in the show notes as well, so people can find you a bit easier as well, Katie. But it's been an absolute pleasure having you on. Thank you so much for joining.
You're welcome.
Hey everyone, thanks again for listening to the Woofing Possum podcast. As always, if you do want to get in touch, you can find us on social media. I'm at Great Paws NE, which is Great Paws NE for Northeast, on both Facebook and Instagram. You can also contact me via my website, which is greatpaws.co.uk. And you can also consume some free online courses at greatpawsgang.co.uk. Excellent. Thank you very much, folks. And we will see you soon for our next episode.